Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Ecclesiastes chapter 7. I will call the chapter The Contrast of Wisdom and Folly. Solomon, of course, wrote this. We start now in Ecclesiastes 7:1. Solomon says, "A good name is better than a good ointment, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth." Now, that's a strange piece of wisdom. A good name is better than a good ointment, better than Bengay. A good name, of course, refers to reputation, but not only reputation with man, but with God also. But why is the day of one's death better than the day of one's birth? That seems counterintuitive. Here's a couple of options to explain that. Option one, death is better for the one who believes in God. It's better to be going to God than living in all the trials and toils of this world. This would assume that Solomon is speaking of the one who has a good name being a believer in God, and so when someone dies, he will go to God. This assumes, of course, that Solomon believes in life after death, which I'm sure he did. But there's another way to read that. Solomon could be saying this, the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth, because at death, one has passed all the troubles of this life. But at birth, the man's troubles have just begun. It reminds me of a friend of mine at a party. There was a 2-year-old kid there. Kid fell down and started crying, and my friend looked at that kid and says, "You think it's bad now, you just wait." Well, I never forgot that. I about died laughing. Life is hard, and when you die, it's over with, that hard life. I think that's what Solomon is getting at here. We go now to Ecclesiastes 7, verses 2 through 4. Solomon continues, "It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for a fool's is in the house of pleasure." Now, these three verses do seem counterintuitive also. Why would you rather go to a house of mourning than a house of feasting? Why is sorrow better than laughter? The answer is why you would rather go to a house of mourning than to a house of feasting is because the house of mourning is a place where people talk of ultimate things. They realize somebody is dead, they quit thinking about the vanities of this world, and they start thinking about their ultimate fate. I did a funeral recently, and I thought to myself, this is the best time to give the gospel because people are here looking at a dead person up there in a coffin, and I told the people, I said, every one of you in here is going to be just like this woman in this coffin. You're going to be dead. I had their attention. Couldn't help but have their attention. So a house of mourning is a good place to think about ultimate things. Now, they didn't have funeral parlors back then. They put dead people in the house of deceased relations or maybe a friend. And so this could be referring to the unburied body lying in the house, or it could be referring to the corpse having just been buried. The friends come back to the house and have a mutual comfort session, as people do even today, while the body is not there. The Jews actually mourned for several days after burial. So it could be a house of mourning after the burial or while the body is still in the house. It doesn't matter. We're thinking about death. Better to go there than to a house of feasting. Now, this house of feasting is a place where fools feast. This feasting is referring to sensual enjoyments. This type of feasting is contrasted with the proper use of food and drink in other chapters of Ecclesiastes. For example, in Ecclesiastes 3:13, Solomon says, "Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. Nothing wrong with eating and drinking. Nothing wrong with feasting. After all, the Lord's Supper is a feast. But this feasting is the feasting of fools." We know that because at the end of verse 3, Solomon says, "For a fool's is in the house of pleasure." Ecclesiastes 5:18 also has a reference by Solomon to legitimate eating and drinking. Solomon says, "Here is what I have seen to be good and fitting, to eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him, for this is his reward." Now in verse 2, Solomon says, "This is the end of every man," meaning death, "and the living takes it to heart." In other words, the living thinks about death. Why does he think about death? Because he's in a house of mourning. Psalms 90, verse 12, a psalm written by Moses according to the heading. Moses says this, "Teach us to number our days carefully so that we may develop wisdom in our hearts." Number our days carefully. Realize we're not going to live forever, and that will develop wisdom in your heart. John Gill says of this taking to heart the mortality of human beings as one visits the house of mourning, John Gill says, quote, the heart is drawn off from vain, carnal, and sensual things and is engaged in the contemplation of spiritual and heavenly ones. We move now to Ecclesiastes 7, verses 5 through 7. Solomon continues, it is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. And this too is futility. For oppression makes a wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Every time I think about the laughter of the fool that Solomon mentions, I think about fraternity parties at college. Fools. Sorority gatherings. Fools. Laughing, drunken, partying. Idiots. Now Solomon says in verse 5, it's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than to listen to the song of fools. Well, that's obvious. Here's some other scriptures saying the same thing, also written by Solomon in Proverbs. Proverbs 15, verses 31 through 32. In that section of scripture, Solomon says, he whose ear listens to the life-giving reproof will dwell among the wise. He who neglects discipline despises himself, but he who listens to reproof acquires understanding. Solomon says in Proverbs 17:10, a rebuke goes deeper into one who has understanding than 100 blows into a fool. Just yesterday, I had an old friend of mine come around to visit, and he mentioned something that happened 20, 30 years ago that I had rebuked him. And he says he still remembers where he received the phone call. And he told me what I had said. And he says it just shook him to his core. And I thought to myself, I don't remember that. And I still don't remember it. But he listened to what I said because he said the first thing he did after he hung up was he thought to himself, but is he right? He said the reason I didn't remember it because I was the offender and he was the offended, and that's why he remembered it. But at any rate, he says, was I right? And he immediately began to change his course of action. He was showing wisdom by doing that. There's some continuity with this idea of being in a house of mourning and receiving rebuke. Both are unpleasant. It's sad to be in a house of mourning, but wisdom can be gotten there. It's sad to receive a rebuke, but wisdom can be gotten there too. Now, the fool's laughter is said to be like the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot. Thorn bushes are useless for fuel. They burn very quickly, exceedingly fast, and they stick you while you're trying to put it under the pot anyway. They're worthless for anything. They crackle, for as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, perhaps this is the point of analogy that Solomon is trying to make, the laughter of the fool is like crackling. Thorn bushes make a loud blaze and a lot of noise at first as they crackle, but only for a short time. Then they are extinguished. The fool will be extinguished too. His laughing will be extinguished. The laughter of the fool is futility. Striving after the wind. He doesn't say striving after the wind here, but we know what he means. Futility means meaninglessness. Verse 7, Solomon says, for oppression makes a wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Well, what does he mean by saying that oppression makes a wise man mad? Two options here. The first option, I believe, is the correct one. Solomon is saying that a wise man becomes crazy with grief when he sees oppression, either the oppression of himself or the oppression of others. Wise people don't like oppression. Fools do. This is the contrast, of course. That's the name of this chapter, the contrast between wisdom and folly. Fools like oppression, but wise men don't. I think that's what Solomon meant. Another way you could interpret that, though, is by saying a wise man is corrupted and becomes crazy when he oppresses others. For oppression of others makes a wise man doing the oppression mad, would be the way to read this verse according to this option. But I've got a problem with that. Why would a wise man oppress others? As soon as he does that, he's not wise. The NIV sort of sounds like this is the way they take it. They say extortion turns a wise man into a fool. Well, I guess that makes sense. But again, why would a wise man all of a sudden become a fool? I don't really think that's very likely. We go now to Ecclesiastes 7, verses 8 through 9. Solomon continues, the end of a matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. Do not be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. Again, we're contrasting wisdom and folly here in another aspect. Verse 8, Solomon says, the end of a matter is better than its beginning. This is assuming that Solomon is talking about a good matter that ends well for righteous people. Obviously, the end of a failed bank robbery is not as good as the beginning of the bank robbery. That would make no sense. So what Solomon is trying to exhort us to here is endurance, patience. In fact, he says at the end of verse 8, patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. And of course, patience is just another old-fashioned way of saying endurance. Now, let me read you some learned quotations from Adam Clark concerning this statement that the end of a matter is better than its beginning? Quote, "At the beginning, we are often apt to make very rash conjectures and often suppose that such and such things are against us and that everything is going wrong." Well, that's true. Building a house, starting a business, starting an academic career, whatever it is you're doing, the beginning is always harder than the end. Laying the foundation is always the slowest. You've got less experience. You see progress going slower than before. It's just the way it is. Learning something, there's a steep learning curve. You learn very gradually at first, then all of a sudden you hit the bend in the learning curve and you start learning stuff, and the end becomes better than the beginning. Now, Adam Clark quotes a contemporary of his, a Dr. Byram, who says this, quote, "With patient mind thy course of duty run. God nothing does, nor suffers to be done, but thou wouldst do thyself, couldst thou but see the end of all events as well as he." Well, if we can parse all that King James English, God can see the end of something. You start out something and it looks like it's a waste of time and there's too much trouble and the obstacles are too many. But if you could see the end, the future, like God does, you would say, okay, I'll put up with this so I can get to the end. And so faith in your good enterprises ending up well is what gives you endurance and helps you keep moving when things are looking bad. Adam Clark says, "Wait the result, nor ask with frantic rage why God permits such things," in other words, when everything goes wrong. "His ways, though now involved in clouds and darkness, will appear all right when from thine eyes the mist is cleared. Till then, to learn submission to his will, more wisdom shows than vainly thus to attempt exploring what thou canst not comprehend, and God for wisest ends thinks fit to hide." I love how these commentators start using King James English. Clark was beyond that, but he did. Basically, what he's saying is, everything looks dark now, clouds and darkness. To put it in more modern English, think of that old country hymn, "Farther along, we'll understand it. Farther along, we'll understand why." And by the way, all you Presbyterians out there, you need to get into this revivalist hymnology. I've heard so many theological types complain about that music. That music is wonderful because it talks about the afterlife. Yeah, sure. Maybe they de-emphasize what goes on in this life. It might be because their lives are hard, but they have a view of heaven. Just build me a cabin in the corner of glory land. Life is like a mountain railway with an engineer so brave. The sun's setting. I forgot exactly how the lyrics go, but that hymnology is wonderful. It helps people get through the vicissitudes of life when you think about heaven on the other side. Patience of spirit, endurance, is better than hardiness of spirit. Hardiness of spirit says, I can handle it. Things are going bad, but I'm a big shot. I can do it. I'm strong. Verse 9, do not be eager in your heart to be anger. Verse 9 says, do not be eager in your heart to be angry. Angry because things are not going well. The beginning of your enterprise has not started out the way you wanted it to. Don't be angry about it. Anger resides in the bosom of fools. Don't be angry, but be patient. Endure. Tough it out with God's grace, and he'll get you through. Maybe you started out in a marriage, and it doesn't go so well because you're both full of flesh. Don't divorce. Work it out. Confess. Repent. Let the Holy Spirit mortify the deeds of your flesh. That's the wise thing to do. Patience rather than hardiness is how one has a better chance of a good ending. Here's some scriptures, appropriate scriptures. James 1:19, "This you know, my beloved brethren, but everyone must be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger." Proverbs 16:32, "He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who captures a city." Proverbs 12:16, "A fool's anger is known at once, but a prudent man conceals dishonor." I'm assuming the dishonor is getting angry. Solomon wrote those last two Proverbs. Paul wrote Romans 5:3. Paul says, "And not only this, but we also exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance." King James has patience, endurance. Tribulation, things don't go well. You have to endure. There is no Christian that has ever been exempt from persecution and trials in this life. We go now to Ecclesiastes 7, verse 10. Solomon says, "Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask about this." Ah, the good old days. Longing for the good old days is a human characteristic. I confess, I myself have done it many times. At one time, I realized that I was a total reactionary. But I read a lot of history, and I realize that the human condition has been very, very bad for a very long time. Ask all those in Eastern Europe. when they were subjugated by the Nazis, then subjugated by the communists. And then they were ripped out of their homes, those that survived, and translocated from one place to another, their homes destroyed, their houses destroyed, their culture destroyed. I talked to a lot of people today that talk about how bad things are in America, and they are bad. They are truly bad. But I remember back during the Vietnam War, now, folks, that was bad. And I also remember 100 years before the Vietnam War, I don't remember it, but I read about it, was the war between the states. Now, you talk about bad. That was really bad. So Solomon says, it is not from wisdom that you ask about the former days, the good old days. It's stupid to do that. The best thing to do is endure the unpleasantness of today and hope for a better tomorrow in God. There has been violence, evil, oppression, fraud, rape, sexual sin, you name it, in every age. The Roman Empire, the Middle Ages. We go now to Ecclesiastes 7, verses 11 through 12. Solomon continues, wisdom along with an inheritance is good and an advantage to those who see the sun. For wisdom is protection just as money is protection. But the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. Verse 11 is obvious enough. Wisdom is a good thing. Solomon also says that in verse 19, which comes up a few verses later. Wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. And two chapters later in Ecclesiastes 9, verse 16, Solomon says, so I said, wisdom is better than strength. So wisdom is an advantage to those who see the sun. At the end of verse 11, who are those who see the sun? That's just a poetic way of saying mortals who live their daily lives out in the natural world because they can see the sun. Of course, once you're dead and in the grave, you don't see the sun anymore. So wisdom in this life is a good thing. Easy enough. Now in verse 12, we read, for wisdom is protection just as money is protection. Now, we could look at verse 12 and say that Solomon is contradicting himself because Solomon in verse 12 says that money is protection, but we know what he said about riches. A couple of chapters worth of that. Chasing after money is stupid, folly, striving after the wind, but here he says something positive about money. Money is protection. Now, Adam Clark is one such commentator who thinks that Solomon is contradicting himself if you take this literally. Or, I should say, if you take this as a statement of Solomon. But what Clark says is that this is not a statement of Solomon. Solomon is taking this statement as an objector to his doctrine. And he's saying, okay, quotation mark, not in the original text, but we added here. So Solomon is saying, okay, objector, you say that wisdom is protection just as money is protection. But I'm here to tell you, no. Knowledge is wisdom that preserves the lives of its possessors, and you, objectors, are wrong. Let me read you some of his comments. Quote, in this chapter, Solomon introduces many observations which appear to be made by objectors against his doctrine, and as he was satisfied of their futility, he proposes them in their own full strength and then combats and destroys them. Clark continues, it is quite necessary to attend to this, else we shall take the objectors' words for those of Solomon. And think, as some have done, that the wise man contradicts and refutes himself. Well, I believe that this is Solomon's statement. Money is protection. I don't believe it's some hypothetical objector to Solomon. But I also don't believe that Solomon refutes himself. I'll say why in a minute. Clark goes on to say, observations, reflections, and objections of friends and adversaries are frequently introduced in the works of ancient authors without mentioning them as such. This is frequent, more particularly in ethic writers, and we have many specimens in Horace, and without this distinction, it would be impossible to make sense of some of his writings. Clark goes on to say, here an objector who had listened to the wise man declaiming in favor of wisdom suddenly interrupts him and says, in effect, I grant the truth of what you have said. Wisdom is very good in its place, but what is it without property? A man who has a good inheritance may be profited by wisdom, because it will show how to manage it to the best advantage. And then Solomon is said to answer this by saying, in effect, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, that wisdom no less shields one from the ills of life than money does. Well, I really wish that the original languages had quotation marks. I believe that quotation marks, whoever invented them, that person should be given a pat on the back, because I believe that quotation marks are very, very helpful in interpreting things, but we don't have them. Well, Clark could be right, but I don't see any reason why we cannot take Solomon literally here and say that Solomon is saying that wisdom and money are, in fact, good things. Money is protection, but wisdom is better. just because Solomon has gone on and on and on in the book of Proverbs about how evil money is chasing after it, and also in the book of Ecclesiastes, he also says in some places that money is okay. It's okay to eat, drink, as long as you don't put it ahead of everything else. You don't put money ahead of wisdom. I don't have the cites with me, but if you've listened to my audios on Proverbs, you will see how many times Solomon does that. Solomon says there's nothing wrong with money, and of course there's nothing wrong with wisdom as long as they're not thought to be of ultimate value. In fact, in one place, Solomon says that wisdom is bad because you're putting that ahead of God. So Solomon is speaking moderation here. He agrees, yes, money is protection, but it's better to be wise. Now here's a verse that Solomon wrote in Proverbs 18:11 that says that riches do not protect one. A rich man's wealth is his strong city and like a high wall in his own imagination. In other words, his wealth is just an imaginary protection. And that's true, but that doesn't contradict what Solomon says here. Money is protection, because money is protection only in a limited sense. If you think it's going to ultimately protect you, then you're fools. That takes a little finessing, but I think that handles it much better than Adam Clark does. Now in verse 12, Solomon says, the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. I think you can see there that knowledge and wisdom are exact synonyms, at least the way Solomon uses the words. Sometimes in the New Testament, we want to distinguish the two. For example, Paul says, if one has a word of wisdom and one has a word of knowledge in the chapters on charismatic gifts in 1 Corinthians, sometimes people make a distinction. A word of knowledge is a factual matter is revealed to somebody, but a word of wisdom is, how do you use that knowledge? And I guess I can make that distinction. It's a fine distinction, but it is a distinction which is not made in the wisdom literature of Solomon. We go now to Ecclesiastes 7, verses 13 through 14, and Solomon continues. Consider the work of God, for who is able to straighten what he has bent? In the day of prosperity, be happy, but in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man will not discover anything that will be after him. Now, these two verses are going to take some interpretation. Verse 13, consider the work of God. Now, the work of God in these two verses are the day of prosperity and the day of adversity. So, notice that bad times are a work of God just as are good times. That's something we might not instinctively believe. For who is able to straighten what he has bent? In other words, the current bad situation, he's bent things. See? Now, of course, the faith people will say, that's the devil always does that. But this verse says God did it. Who is able to straighten what God, he, capital H, he has bent? And so this verse is apparently addressed to those who were complaining that the good old days were better. Remember that. Don't think about the former days. That's folly to do that. That's in verse 10. That's very tempting when things are bad. Think about the good old days. But Solomon has a better idea. He says, well, if things are going good, be happy, sure. But in the day of adversity, remember, God made that just like he made the good days, and you cannot discover what will come after this adversity. It could be good. So just let him take care of it and endure. Remember, he's already said patience is a good thing in verse 8. So essentially, these two verses are exhortations by Solomon that his readers will not be depressed by adversity because God made the adversity, and so God can make prosperity too after the adversity is over with. The person undergoing adversity cannot discover anything that will be after the adversity, but God knows what's coming afterwards, and he's got it all under control. Now, Adam Clark says concerning prosperity, God has balanced prosperity and adversity against each other, and were it not so, how many would put the former in the place of God himself? Well, that's what everybody does. That's their God is being prosperous. In fact, sometimes it's being rich prosperous. Prosperity, of course, means success and other things besides finances, but my career, my job, whatever. People will always put that ahead of God. But the person that does that does not know what comes after his prosperity either. And it might be bad stuff. So you better realize that God is who controls whether things are prosperous or adverse. So whichever way, whichever situation you're in, if you're prosperous, you better realize it might not last. And if you are in an adverse circumstance, realize the adversity might not continue either. God is in control. We go now to Ecclesiastes 7, verses 15 through 18. Solomon says, I have seen everything during my lifetime of futility. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. Do not be excessively righteous and do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Do not be excessively wicked and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp one thing and also not let go of the other, for the one who fears God comes forth with both of them. Now, these verses are not immediately obvious. First of all, we see in verse 15, Solomon says, his life is a lifetime of futility. He was a king, a rich king, a wise king, and he still says his lifetime was meaningless, futile. He's seen everything. He's seen it all. He's an old man now, and he sees that there's no justice in this, and he sees that there is not perfect justice in this world. There's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness. Some people just get screwed royally. And there's a wicked man who prolongs his life. There's some wicked people who prosper. They're very rich and powerful. And then Solomon says something strange here in verse 16. Do not be excessively righteous and do not be overly wise. Now, what in the world does that mean? Well, when he says do not be excessively righteous, that righteousness does not refer to true righteousness. It's impossible to be overly righteous with regard to true righteousness. It refers to pharisaical righteousness. Don't put on a show and don't engage in ostentation like fleshly righteous people do, thus despising those who don't measure up to your righteousness. This type of righteousness will lead to censoriousness and rigidity in one's judgment of others. For example, I'm staying up all night praying. I'm fasting. I haven't eaten in 3 days. Look at me. I'm praying all the time, 2-3 hours a day. I'm denying myself. I don't spend money on anything. This type of righteousness would be a fanatical, pharisaical righteousness separated from God. Now, this verse would have been a good verse for the medieval monks to have considered. Do not be excessively righteous, you who are sitting on a pillar, stamen stylites, in Sirius, living on a pillar. I would consider that to be excessively righteous. And then Solomon says at the end of verse 16, do not be overly wise. Now, what does that mean? Well, it could mean studying too hard and ruining one's health, because being overly wise is said to ruin yourself. Do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Being excessively righteous also leads to the ruin of yourself for obvious reasons, but also being overly wise, studying too hard, acting like a know-it-all, and having men that are ticked off by your arrogance, they will come back and they will come after you, or trying to be wise in things for which you have no capacity, then you will be exposed as a fool. Now, that's the straightforward way to explain this enigmatic verse 16, don't be excessively righteous and don't be overly wise. You take the righteous to be fake righteousness, and you take the wisdom as being superficial, arrogant wisdom. But some people take verse 16 and say this again is an objector to Solomon. Do not be excessively righteous, Solomon. Don't be overly wise. And Solomon says, no, we need to be excessively righteous and we need to be overly wise. I don't like that approach. I just think that Solomon is talking about fake righteousness and fake wisdom. In verse 17, Solomon says, do not be excessively wicked. Well, actually, one should not be wicked at all. So why does Solomon say don't be excessively wicked? He's saying that especially one should not go into the greater lengths of sin that one has already committed. You've already been wicked, but then don't keep going at it and be deeper into sin's snare. Don't be a fool. Why should you die before your time? At the end of verse 17, why might you die from being excessively wicked, from bodily dissipation and disease that comes from sinning? You might be capitally executed by the government because of your sin. You might commit suicide through despair. Now in verse 18, Solomon says, it is good that you grasp one thing and also not let go of the other. Well, what in the world does that mean? Well, the one thing is being excessively righteous, and the other is being excessively wicked. And so what Solomon is saying here, grasping one thing is, don't be excessively righteous, and don't let go of the other thing is, don't be excessively wicked. Hold on to both of those negatives. Don't be overly righteous, and don't be overly wicked. As the pulpit commentary says, the pronouns, he's referring to a translation that has, that you grasp this, but also don't let go of this either. Those pronouns, they're not obvious in my translation here, the NASB. But the pulpit commentary says the pronouns this and this refer to the two warnings of verses 16 and 17. Verse 16 is the warning against over-righteousness, and verses 17 is the warning against over-wickedness. And the Cambridge commentary says this is a common interpretation. They've got some other interpretation which I couldn't understand, so we're going to take the general run-of-the-mill interpretation of this. And basically, the exhortation is don't use your flesh to try to be righteous. Don't use your flesh to be wise. You're going to ruin yourself. You're going to be a fool. You're going to die before your time. Actually, you're going to die before your time if you're excessively wicked. That's obvious, but I suspect he also means you're going to die before your time if you're excessively righteous, self-righteous, and if you're overly wise, you're a wise acre, a know-it-all. And Solomon finishes verse 18 by saying, for the one who fears God comes forth with both of them. In other words, the one who fears God escapes the extremes of being excessively righteous and excessively wicked. We move now to Ecclesiastes 7, verses 19 through 20. Solomon continues, wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins. In verse 19, when Solomon says wisdom strengthens a wise man, perhaps he is referring to the context, wisdom strengthens a wise man against the extremes that we just mentioned, the extremes of excessive righteousness, self-righteousness, and being excessively wicked. More than 10 rulers, 10 kings, mounted on horseback with a lot of army behind them. And then we go to verse 20. Solomon says, indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins. Now, that word indeed is a little problematical because it sounds like wisdom is a good thing in verse 19. And then in verse 20, yes, but certainly there are no good righteous people. In other words, wise people. It makes it sound a little contradictory. John Gill says to avoid that, that word indeed should be translated although or notwithstanding. So the verse would read, the verses would read, wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city, although there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and never sins. In other words, it would be great to have a wise man, but you're not going to find one. Well, let's look at a couple of ways we can interpret this verse 20, indeed, there is not a righteous man. The first option is to say that what Solomon is referring to here is that these excessively righteous people that Solomon has just warned against in verse 16, don't think that they never sin. They're Pharisees. They sin. They sin all the time. So don't think that. True wisdom will strengthen a wise man. However, the fake type of wisdom, which says that a man never sins, is not to be had because there's nobody who never sins. That's one way to look at it. Or we could just take it straightforwardly and say that Solomon means that even the good righteous men, not the fake pharisaical type of righteous people, not the self-righteous people, but the truly righteous people, even they're going to sin every now and then. Both of those options are true. I'm not really sure what Solomon meant. Now, let's go on a little theological rabbit trail here. Adam Clark says, this text that says the righteous man never sins, this text has been a wonderful stronghold for all who believe that there is no redemption from sin in this life, that no man can live without committing sin, and that we cannot be entirely freed from it until we die. Now, Clark is an Arminian, and he might have been a Wesleyan, I don't know. Not all Arminians are Wesleyans who believe in sinless perfection. Wesley believed that in our life under the sun, we can reach a point where we make no willful sins. He says it's impossible to avoid inadvertent sins, but I don't know what Clark is talking about here. He says we should not believe that we cannot be entirely freed from sin until we die. Does that mean we're sinlessly perfect? Sounds like it. And then Clark says, here are the reasons why that we cannot use this phrase, this verse in verse 20 that says a righteous man never sins, is because, one, the text speaks of no such doctrine. It only speaks of the possibility of every man sinning. And this must be true of a state of probation. Argument number two, there is not another text in the divine records that is more to the purpose than this. Three, the doctrine is flatly in opposition to the design of the gospel, for Jesus came to save his people from their sins and to destroy the works of the devil. Four, it is a dangerous and destructive doctrine and should be blotted out of every Christian's creed. There are too many who are seeking to excuse their crimes by all means in their power, and we need not embody their excuses in a creed to complete their deception and stating that their sins are unavoidable. Now, I'm sure that Clark is complaining about Calvinists who say that despite people's sins, they're going to be saved anywhere, they're going to persevere, they're going to be in heaven, all of which I completely agree with. So the way Clark would read this is Solomon is saying there's no man who exists for whom there is no possibility of sinning. Of course, we all can possibly sin, Clark would say, but that doesn't mean that it is impossible to be perfectly pure and perfectly holy. Well, I think the two extremes that one can go to here. If you say that you will always be a sinner, a sinner, a sinner, and that's all you will ever be, this is what the Reformed people say all the time, yes, that very quickly gets into defeatism. But if, on the other hand, you say that you can actually conquer sin completely and never have to deal with it anymore, well, that's sinless perfection. There's got to be a middle course, and the middle course is this. You will always have sin to deal with, but you can always conquer it. That doesn't mean it disappears. It doesn't mean that you can avoid fighting it, but Paul said the Holy Spirit will mortify the deeds of your flesh in Romans chapter 8. So that means you can beat sin. So we don't want to be defeated, but we don't want to be triumphalist about it either. Now, of course, if Solomon here is talking about a self-righteous man who never sins, there is not a self-righteous man, a fake righteous man on earth who never sins, well, then we don't have to get into that theological discussion. But if Solomon is talking about a truly righteous man who continually does good and never sins, there's never somebody like that, well, now we can hit the sinless perfection people with that verse, despite what Adam Clark says. We go now to Ecclesiastes 7, verses 21 through 22. Solomon continues, "Also, do not take seriously all words which are spoken, so that you will not hear your servant cursing you. For you also have realized that you likewise have many times cursed others." In other words, in verse 21, don't listen to your servant if you hear him or overhear him cursing you. Why is that? Well, because a servant is likely to gripe about his boss. How many times have you griped about your boss to your fellow workers? You say things that you would not say to your boss. You say to them to your co-workers. Well, if the boss happens to hear this, Solomon is essentially saying, don't fire them until they say those things straight to your face. This reminds me of one time I had a friend who has a small business, and he set up security cameras, and he was watching the tape one day and found out his employees were just making fun of him and saying all kind of bad things about him. He fired him. I would think it would be hard to not take seriously such words, but Solomon says don't take seriously all words which are spoken. Sometimes you hear things, it's better just to let it go. Don't get all in a huff and start talking about taking revenge. Be just a little bit less sensitive. Have a skin that's just a little bit thicker. Why should you do that? Because in verse 22, "For you also have realized that you likewise have many times cursed others." How many times have you complained about your boss? Of course, the best wisdom here is don't curse anybody. Don't talk bad about your boss, not to your fellow workers, not to anybody. We go now to Ecclesiastes 7, verses 23 through 25. Solomon says, "I tested all this with wisdom, and I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. What has been is remote and exceedingly mysterious. Who can discover it? I directed my mind to know, to investigate, and to seek wisdom and an explanation, and to know the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness." Now, in verse 23, when Solomon says he tested all this, what's he referring to? All of the things before mentioned in the book of Ecclesiastes, or perhaps all the things before mentioned in this chapter? Probably the whole book. And he says, I'm going to be wise. But what he meant was he was going to be wise in his own strength, in his own flesh. And that's why he says wisdom was far from him in verse 23. In verse 24, he says that wisdom is remote and exceedingly mysterious. He can't find it. The things that God has done, who can discover it? The things that God has done in creation and in providence and history. So in verse 25, Solomon says, I directed my mind to know. Now, a question arises here. Why would Solomon try to discover what he just said was undiscoverable? Well, I think the answer to that is there's not a strict time sequence here. What he means is when he was testing all of his propositions in the book of Ecclesiastes, that's when he directed his mind to know, to investigate, to seek wisdom and an explanation, to know the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. And that's when he discovered that all of that was far from him. Knowing about the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness and why something is wise and why something is foolish, it was too remote, mysterious. He couldn't understand it. Solomon actually could be talking about his own folly. I directed my mind to know the evil of folly. He married 1,000 adulterous wives. Life didn't turn out so good for him, despite all of his earthly advantages. We go now to Ecclesiastes 7, verses 26 through 28. Solomon continues, "And I discovered more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are chains. One who is pleasing to God will escape from her, but the sinner will be captured by her. Behold, I have discovered this," says the preacher, adding one thing to another to find an explanation, which I am still seeking but have not found. I have found one man among 1,000, but I have not found a woman among all these. So this was the result of all his diligent search for wisdom that he mentioned in the previous verses. He discovered something more bitter than death, an adulteress. Now, he doesn't use the word adulteress here. He says the woman, but that's what he means. Now, Solomon had a big deal about adultery. He exhorted his son against the snares of adulterous women a good bit in the book of Proverbs, if you will recall. This is what John Gill says about this. Far from Solomon's intention to reflect upon and reproach, nor any woman in particular, not Eve, the first woman through whom came sin and death into the world, but an adulterous woman. And I don't see any problem with applying Solomon's words to modern-day feminists. Their heart is snares and nets. Their hands are chains. John Gill says, to be ensnared by an adulterous woman brings not only such diseases of body as are both painful and scandalous, but such horrors into the conscience when awakened as are intolerable and exposes to eternal death. I wish John Gill's words could be whispered into the ear of somebody contemplating adultery. That's serious business. You could get killed doing that. Verse 27, Solomon says, behold, I've discovered this. This being that an adulterous woman is more bitter than death. I have discovered this, says the preacher. Solomon's referring to himself. He calls himself the preacher or the teacher in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 1. The words of the teacher, son of David, that would be Solomon. King in Jerusalem, that would be Solomon. I like teacher better than preacher. Preacher's sort of ambiguous. Holman Christian Study Bible has teacher, NASB has preacher. And so Solomon says he's discovered that an adulteress is more bitter than death, adding one thing to another to find an explanation. Well, here's some options as to what this one thing to another means. The most straightforward probability is that Solomon is adding one piece of wisdom to another piece of wisdom. It could be option number two, that he's adding one sin to another, and he finally adds up all those sins, and he says, you know, this is not doing me any good. Or it could be he's contemplating the good works of the righteous, and then he adds to that the sins of the wicked, adding one thing to another, righteous things to unrighteous things. I don't think so. Here's a really good off-the-wall option. Solomon is talking about women. I've added one woman to another to find out that adultery with such a woman is more bitter than death. I don't think that's the proper interpretation. I think he's just saying I've got one piece of wisdom, I added it to another piece of wisdom, and it all came together. Jot upon jot, tittle upon tittle. Verse 28, Solomon says, which I am still seeking, the explanation which I am still seeking, but I have not found. He's talking about the explanation of wisdom, the things that were remote and exceedingly mysterious that could not be found, that he mentioned in verse 24. He's still looking for that. In verse 25, the explanation he's looking for is the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. In verse 25, he says, I directed my mind to know, to investigate, and to seek wisdom and an explanation, and to know the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. He's still looking for wisdom. In verse 28, he says, that wisdom I am still seeking, but I have not found it. And then he says something which could be interpreted in such a way that would make King Solomon a misogynist. Solomon says, I have found one man among a thousand, but I have not found a woman among all these. Well, first of all, before we get into that issue, whether Solomon was a bad boy or not, let's talk about who this one man among a thousand that he's found. Option number one, the one man that he has found is the one man who has escaped out of all the men who have been ensnared by adulterous women. Solomon actually may be thinking of himself. After all, he didn't need to be an adulterer. He had 1,000 wives, so every time he catted around, it was legal. But I don't think that's the proper option. Because Solomon says he's found one man among 1,000 who's escaped the snares of an adulteress, but have not found a woman out of these 1,000 that have escaped the snares of an adulteress. That makes no sense. Now, you could say, well, Solomon is saying, I have found one man out of 1,000 who's escaped the snares of adultery, but I've not found a woman among 1,000 who have escaped the snares of adultery. But do we really believe that there's 1,000 women in Solomon's society who've not escaped adultery? That there's out of 1,000 women, there's 1,000 adulteresses? I don't think so. So we're going to scratch that option. Now, option number one being only one man has escaped from adultery out of 1,000 men. Now, option number two, Solomon looking at men, 1,000 men, he's only found one wise man amongst 1,000. And I think that's the proper interpretation. Now, I've got two translations which back me up on this. The first is Holman Christian Study Bible, Ecclesiastes 7:28. which my soul continually searches for but does not find. The explanation of wisdom. Among 1,000 people, I have found one true man. A true man. Now, that true is in brackets. It's not in the original text, but that's how the translators interpreted the text, and that's the way I interpret it, too. Ecclesiastes 7:28, the NIV confirms the same interpretation. The NIV says, I found one upright man among 1,000. Upright man. Home of Christian Study Bible says a true man. The NIV says Solomon found an upright man. One out of 1,000. And that's what Solomon meant, I'm sure. Solomon is a little depressed about the state of wisdom on the earth, and for good reason, I might add. Adam Clark says, this is a lamentable account of the state of morals in Judea in the days of the wise King Solomon. Thank God it would not be difficult to get a tithe of both in the same number in the present day. So Adam Clark thinks in his England in the 1800s, he could find 100 true and upright men out of 1,000. Well, I'll tell you what, you're not going to find that many in present day America. I can guarantee you that. Now in verse 28 at the end, Solomon says, I have not found a woman among all these. One man among 1,000 is found, but I have not found a woman. So one man out of 1,000, zero women out of 1,000. Ooh, does that make Solomon a misogynist? Well, before we get into that, let's look at some options as to what Solomon is talking about. Who are these women, these 1,000 women that he's talking about? Gill gives us option number one. Solomon would be saying, of all the harlots he knew, not one escaped their harlotry. So Solomon is not talking about women in general. He's talking about adulteresses and whores. Well, I don't think that's the right answer because it doesn't really match the first part of the verse. If you take the first part of the verse saying, Solomon says, I have not found one true and upright man among 1,000, then all of a sudden you switch to, I have found zero women who were true and upright. That doesn't sound like Solomon's talking about women who've escaped the chains of adultery. So option number two is Solomon is saying of all his 1,000 wives and concubines, there was not a wise one. Now, he uses that term 1,000 here, which of course is a general term meaning a lot. But Solomon did have 1,000 wives and concubines. And he says, I've found one man among 1,000 that's true and upright, but I've not found a woman among all the 1,000 wives I have who's true and upright. Whew, if that's true. You talk about one unhappily married man. We know that Solomon had 1,000 wives and concubines by reading 1 Kings 11:3. Solomon had 700 wives who were princesses and 300 concubines, and they turned his heart away from the Lord. Well, if Solomon is talking about those 1,000, he's not talking about women in general. So if he's talking about 1,000 harlots, he's not talking about women in general. If he's talking about 1,000 wives and concubines, he's not talking about women in general. So he's not stereotyping women as being unrighteous or unwise. Now, the third option as to what women he's talking about 1,000 women found in the world in general, not adulteresses, not his wives, but just women in general. And what he's saying is, amongst women in general, I have not found a true woman. There is not one upright woman of all the women in the world. Again, let me read you these two translations. Holman Christian Study Bible. Among all these, I have not found a true woman, T-R-U-E. And that's not in brackets in the Holman Christian Study Bible. That must be in the original text. Ecclesiastes 7:28, the NIV says, I found one upright man among 1,000, but not one upright woman among them all. So if this is the true option, and I think it is, what Solomon is saying, I looked at 1,000 men, I found one true and upright man. I looked at 1,000 women, I found zero. So, Solomon is a little misogynistic here. Men one, women zero. But if he is misogynistic here, it ain't by much. He's not trying to compare one sex to the other. He's just trying to say that everybody is screwed up, and that's just the poetic way of saying it. One and zero. That's how they did things in Hebrew poetry. Four things they are bad about this, and here's a fifth one. So, to get away from the trees a little bit, and let's look at the forest in verses 26 through 28. Solomon is saying he's not able to find wisdom. He's found a lot of garbage, a lot of cheating, adultery. He can't find any wise people here. Again, that fits right in with his cynicism about life. Lawless futility and vanity and striving after the wind. We go now to the last verse in Ecclesiastes 7, verse 29. Behold, I have found only this, that God made men upright, but they have sought out many devices. Now, when did God make men upright? Well, when Adam was made, he was made in the image of God. Solomon knew that. He was well aware of Genesis. But then men have sought out many devices. Now, that word devices is the NASB translation. The Holman Christian Study Bible has men have sought out many schemes. Now, if you take devices as the translation, that means that men have sought out many good things, inventions, artifices, products, arts, sciences. The Bible in basic English takes it that way. This only have I seen, that God made men upright, but they have been searching out all sorts of inventions. Well, I don't believe that's the way it ought to be. Holman Christian Study Bible has it this way. Only see this. I have discovered that God made people upright, but they pursued many schemes. They pursued bad things. Schemes. Nasty plans. That's the only thing Solomon says he's found, that the world is full of sin. And Solomon's exactly right. I mean, he might sound pessimistic, but I'm telling you, he's exactly right. You read history long enough, you experience life long enough, and you will know that there ain't much good in this world. Yet God made men upright. He wants to redeem us and get us back to the garden. He also wants to make the world a perfect place. Romans 8, the world will no longer be subject to corruption and bondage to decay. So without that hope, without the knowledge of what God has planned for the future of mankind, you're going to be just as depressed as Solomon was. And that's why there's so many suicides and so many people searching for happiness, either with romance or with drugs or with money or with power or whatever. They're not going to find it. All of their schemes are going to fail. So ladies and gentlemen, we are now prepared to go to Ecclesiastes chapter 8 in our next audio, which I will entitle Keep the King's Command. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.